Jack Whitaker had a pretty good life. 55-year-old contractor in Scott Depot, West Virginia. Self-made millionaire. He didn't live like a wealthy man. He owned a business, a water and sewer pipe business that was worth several million dollars. You know, it wasn't necessarily liquid to that extent. Married to his wife, Jewel, for 36 years. They had one daughter, Ginger. She was 35. And the shining star of my life, as he said, his 15-year-old granddaughter, Brandy Bragg. She was what it was all about for me, he said. From the day she was born, it was all about providing and protecting and taking care of her. He was a hardworking man, well-respected in his hometown, honorable, a philanthropist, gave a lot of money to charities. They had a simple country life that was comfortable. Christmas Day 2002, his life took an unexpected turn. As we would say, everything went sideways. It began, like so many downfalls, through self-indulgence. On August 5th, 2003, just about 8 months later, he called police to report that his car had been broken into and a large sum of money had been stolen. And when the police arrived at the Pink Pony Strip Club in Cross Lanes, West Virginia, they found the money in a trash can behind the place. And they found Jack intoxicated. The manager of the club and his girlfriend admitted they had robbed the car. 3 months later, Jack was arrested after he drove his Hummer into a concrete median on the West Virginia Turnpike. Police found a pistol and a large amount of cash in his car. He refused a sobriety test. About 2 months after that, the next January, he reportedly became intoxicated, parked his car in the middle of the street, and walked away. And police came and found him. He claimed that nearly $100,000 in cash had been stolen from the front seat of his car. The thief was caught. He had indeed stolen $100,000 in cash from the front seat of his car. Whitaker was charged with public intoxication. Police, after investigating, surmised that he left the cash in open sight in the car with it unlocked in the middle of the street. This started a series of run-ins. He was charged with assault and threatening against the owner of a bar in St. Albans a few months later. He was charged with sexual misconduct by a racetrack attendant at a dog track a few months after that. More run-ins, more lawsuits followed. Whitaker estimated that within 10 years of that fateful Christmas morning, he had been involved in more than 460 legal actions. Then what was a series of legal problems turned tragic. In September of 2004, three men broke into Whitaker's house to rob it and discovered a fourth man, Joe Tribble, 18, dead from a drug overdose. The three robbers and the dead man were all four friends of his granddaughter, Brandy Bragg, who was 17 by this time. More tragically, her spectacular public disintegration soon rivaled his. His combination of self-reliance and arrogance became dangerous for her. He showered her with everything she could possibly want. Her own father had committed suicide before. She began running with the wrong crowd, always healthily bootstrapped with money from him, attracting the kind of people you would think a young teenager with a lot of money would attract, drug dealers and petty criminals. Within a year of Christmas morning 2002, she was in rehab for addiction to painkillers. She dropped out of school, spent most of her days sleeping and shopping, and her nights searching for drugs. Her drug of choice was crack cocaine. She drove around in a fancy Mitsubishi that her grandfather had bought her, a car that police later said was literally littered with cash from the money that he gave her. In December 2004, after 2 years, Whitaker decided to stop, or try to stop, the craziness of his life. He surrendered his driver's license, checked into a rehab facility, and reported that day as well that his granddaughter, Brandy, had not been seen for 5 days. 11 days later, a girl's body was found wrapped in plastic tarp behind a van in Scary Creek, West Virginia. The body was in such bad condition that it could only be identified by tattoos on the corpse. It was his granddaughter, Brandy. The death was ruled accidental, overdose of cocaine and methadone in her system at the time of her death. On Christmas Eve, 2004, almost exactly 2 years from that life-changing Christmas morning, Jack Whitaker buried his 17-year-old granddaughter. It didn't get better. 4 years later, his wife of 42 years divorced him and left him. Less than a year after that, his daughter, Ginger Bragg, was found dead in her home, 42 years old. How can anybody's life turn so tragically? You might, you know, you look at circumstances that happen to people and you try to put your finger on it. We've been talking about Joseph a lot. Why do things like this happen? Well, Jack Whitaker, in interviews since that time, looked back to that Christmas morning in 2002 and said, "I wish it had never happened." On that morning, Jack Whitaker found out that he had won $313 million in the West Virginia lottery. I know people, and so do you, who would see an event like that and say, "Why can't that happen to me?" Jack Whitaker, when he was interviewed 10 years after, said, "I wish it had never happened to me." Not because he didn't do some good things with the money. He gave more than half the money away to various charities. That's a noble thing to do. But a man who was already content and already had plenty in life was suddenly thrust into a position where he could have anything that he wanted. And like so many people before him and so many people after him, he was unable to handle that kind of circumstance. Does it bother you that your neighbor has a nicer house than you, or drives a nicer car, or has designer clothes, or things that you don't have? Or somebody you work with, and you know they're lazy and they don't do their work, and you have to do their work because they won't get it done, and just they just keep getting promoted, and you're just stuck where you are. Are you confounded that people of obviously lower socioeconomic standing than you are wearing designer clothes and driving fancy cars, and you know they don't have the income to support that? Do you aspire to move to a nicer neighborhood, to be financially independent, to shop at nicer stores, to eat at the trendy spots, to vacation in destination places? We're human. We think about those things sometimes. My wife likes to watch HGTV. I know none of you other women here like to watch them. We comment sometimes when you see this couple in their late 20s and they're looking for a house and their budget is $2.5 million. It's natural for us at times to think, Boy, what I would do with that. Well, the wise men wrote in Proverbs 23, verse 17, let not your heart envy sinners, but continue to fear in the fear of the Lord all the day. Life is comprised of the haves and the have-nots. And in today's culture, we also have the have-not-paid-for-the-haves. We live in a world that's drowning in debt. And it's not just personal. It's institutional. It's governmental. Everything that is touched by the human mind and the human desires wants more than it has. Wants things it doesn't have. Wants what others have. Consider Jesus' teaching in Matthew chapter 20 in the parable that he taught about the kingdom. This is one of many where he likened the kingdom to a vineyard. In Matthew chapter 20, beginning with verse 1, Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven is like a master of a house who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for a denarii a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And going out about the third hour, he saw others standing idly in the marketplace. And to them he said, you go into the vineyard too, and whatever is right I'll give you. So they went. Going out again about the sixth hour and the ninth hour, he did the same. And about the 11th hour, he went out and found others standing. And he said to them, why do you stand here idle all day? And they said to him, because no one has hired us. He said to them, you go into the vineyard too. And when evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last up to the first. And when those hired about the 11th hour came, each of them received a denarius. Now when those hired first came, they thought they would receive more. But each one of them also received a denarius. And on receiving it, they grumbled at the master of the house, saying, these last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us, who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat. But he replied to one of them, friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last worker as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or do you begrudge my generosity? So the last will be first, and the first will be last. We've been conditioned by our culture to think it's all about fairness and equality. Jesus said here about the kingdom that he's the one that sets the standard, not us. And what may seem to us not to be fair is not of our concern. As the master of the vineyard said in that parable, can I not do with mine what I wish to do with mine? Can God not do as God wishes to do? And who are we to complain about whether he does to us or to someone else? When the all-day workers complained, what were they really saying? Was this fair? Did they have a legitimate complaint? Do we? I want to suggest to you some things tonight about envy. It's very closely related to covetousness, but it's slightly different. And some ways that we can go about getting envy out of our lives. It's a very subtle thing. We think when we are blessed by God and we have an abundance of material things, and listen, most of us do, if something is forbidden us, that's not fair. Or if someone else has something that we don't have, we want to have that, or we want to have something like it. Envy starts by comparing with what others have. Remember a story about, I can't remember where I heard this first, probably a sermon illustration somebody used. It wasn't me. There's a guy working in a factory, and one of the jobs he had, among many, was at the end of the shift each day, he blew the horn to let everybody know it's time to go home. Every day when he would walk to work in the morning, he would pass an old antique shop store. And in the window was this old antique clock. And every day when he passed it, he would stop and he'd look at that clock, and he would synchronize his watch with that clock so that he could ring the bell, the horn, at the right time. He would make sure he was precisely with that clock. And then he'd know when to ring the bell or ring the horn. Well, one day, as he was going to work, he happened to stop into the store. And he was talking to the manager of the store, and he said, I admire that beautiful antique clock that you have in the window. And the owner said, I see you come by here every day, and I see you look at that clock. You know, what is it about that clock? And he said, I'm not really interested in buying it. It's a functional thing. I use your clock to set my watch so I know when to blow the horn to let everybody off work. And the store owner just started laughing. And the guy said, what is it? And he said, I set my clock according to when you blow the horn. What's our measure? What's our standard? You know, when my standard is Jeff's standard, or when Jeff's standard is my standard, we don't have anything foundational to base our standards on. That's the problem that envy presents. We get to comparing, and we don't have anything, a standard that is stable and stationary to compare against. We compare houses and cars and jobs and families by all the things that the world measures success by. But what world? I live in a middle-class house, strictly middle-class. Perhaps even the lower end of it. Hey, I'm okay with that. But I'll tell you something. I go to Mozambique once a year. I live in a palace. And it ain't even close. What standard are we using? If we're just using the standard of somebody else, it's a floating standard. What happens? Well, look at our culture. It's a culture of one-upmanship, is it not? You got that? I can best that. The Pharisees did that sort of thing. Remember in Luke 18 when the publican and the Pharisee came to pray? What did the Pharisee say? Did he go in there and say, Lord, I'm not up to your standard? No, he went in there and said, Lord, I thank you that I'm not like this other man. I fast and I tithe. What was his standard? Other people. As long as I'm better than other people. What did the publican do? He didn't even look up, beat his breast. Lord, be merciful to me, a sinner. What standard did he use? He used God's standard. Found himself wanting quickly. The Pharisee said, well, as long as I'm better than this guy. Jeff and I were up here talking. You know the old joke about getting away from the bear. You don't have to be faster than the bear. You just got to be faster than the other guy. We're comparing. We're not looking at the standard. What the real standard should be, we're just looking at each other. The Apostle Paul was criticized by people who look in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, the passage, and I'll just paraphrase it. I'm not going to turn over and read it. Where Paul said, this is what happens. This is what my critics do. They read my books and they say, oh, his books are powerful and strong. But then when he shows up in person, he's this little bitty guy, and his voice is not very commanding. Paul said, they don't understand the standard by which my authority is based. They look at me and say, well, he can't possibly have anything important to say. This is the same standard that the people who killed Jesus used. When he shuffled out of the carpenter's shop in Nazareth and came down to the Jordan River, and they looked at him and said, what could he possibly have to say that's important? Wrong standard. And so those who criticized Paul, just as those who criticized Jesus, envied him. Note the way people in our world compare themselves. Professional athletes. If I'm the best in my sport, what does that translate into? I get the biggest contract. Yeah, I get the biggest contract. If I'm the best quarterback or the best first baseman or the best pitcher or whatever it is, I'm better than that guy. And you're not going to get me. You know what? What these athletes do when it's new contract time? They don't go sit down and say and ask the owner, "What do you think I'm worth?" They point to the guy who's making the most money and say, "I'm better than him." Well, if I use the standard of everybody else, I can always say that. You know what they don't do? I've yet to see a professional athlete or hear of a professional athlete who's in contract talks, a basketball player, walk in and say, "Well, I'm better than Bill Russell." Because they're not. See, most of y'all don't even know who Bill Russell is. Only one of the finest basketball players ever in the history of the game. Probably never made more than $50,000 in a year. You know, if I were an owner, that'd be, "You're not better than Bill Russell, are you?" "Well, no." "Well, he made 50 grand a year. So what do you think we ought to pay you?" Wrong standards. Let me compare myself to... What about entertainers? This is... You want to see people who put undue credit to their own personal accounts. "Well, I'm not going to work for you if you don't pay me at least this much money." Politicians. I'm so not looking forward to the next 18 months. Because what we'll get is a steady stream of people who will tell you what they're not. "I'm not like him. I'm not like him. I won't do what he said he's going to do. I won't do what she says she's going to do." Instead of telling you what they're going to do, it's about who I'm not. Successful business people. Why do you think we have a Fortune 500 listing? What are we comparing to? Each other. When we compare to each other, we're playing the envy game. The problem is a dissatisfaction with who we are, and it's all around us. Most of us have some link to social media. When you get on social media, what do you most of the time see? People showing you how spectacular their lives are. And you're sitting there scratching your head going, "Well, how come they got to go to Paris? How come they got that new car? How come they did this? How come they did that?" Well, what you don't know is what they had to give up to get that. We don't have any idea. Or how far in debt they might be in order to put themselves in a position where they look up at me and what I'm doing. Let's remember some things. Let's remember David's word in Psalms 139. "You form my inward parts. You've knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made." You know, in all of creation, there's not a single thing God made that comes anywhere close to the majesty and extravagance of the human being. We're not just a little bit better than the apes. No. God put us here on this planet with all of the other living things. We're not the biggest. We're not the strongest. We're not the fastest. We're not the most powerful. Why do we have dominion over all the others? Because we're made in His image. We have a reasoning ability, a thinking ability, rational thought, practicality. Animals don't invent things. We do. They may build themselves rudimentary shelters, but you ever seen an animal build a three-story house? They don't do it. They built airplanes so they can fly, boats so they can sail. They can't do it. Man is so far beyond the capability of any of the animals. It is a staggering thought and a complete absurdity that anyone could possibly believe that man came from animals. It just didn't happen. Man is the final majestic creation. God made us. We are of great value to Him. Jesus said in Luke chapter 12, "Are not five sparrows sold for 2 pennies? And not one of them is forgotten before God? Why, even the hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear not, you are of more value than many sparrows." Why would we fear? Why would we not, as Peter said, cast all our cares on God because He cares for us? He cares for every living creature that he made and takes care of it. And every plant, he takes care of it. And he made them all so that they could survive and thrive. And he put us in the midst of all of us and gave us dominion over that. And our response has been, well, he doesn't know what I want. I'm going to have to do it myself. And that's just foolishness. That's just foolishness. Envy not only compares, but envy conceives of covetousness in the heart. This is where covetousness comes from. It starts with envy. After we're done with our comparison shopping, we want what others have. We move into the category of people who have to have what the haves have. And you know, we covet some of the silliest things. What somebody's eating, what kind of sunglasses they're wearing, what kind of polo shirt they're wearing, their cell phone, their car, their video game, their computer, their tablet, their golf clubs. We can go on and on and on and on. We know better, but our heart learns to covet. The 10th commandment given to Israel, thou shalt not covet, was the one that got at the foundational basis of all those others. It's the one that starts in the heart. It's the one that starts with our thought process that says, I want what someone else has. Now, envy and covetous are slightly different. Sometimes we'll look and say, well, you know, I don't want Scott's car, so I'm not coveting. I just want one like it. That's envy. It's just as wrong. And depending on what actions I take to get that, it may turn into covetousness as well. Covetousness in the heart leads to terrible, terrible things. Stealing, lying, extortion, cheating, adultery, murder. All those things start in the heart with a desire for things that are not right for us to have. Think about Achan in Joshua 7. What happened to Israel? You know, they took out Jericho in spectacular fashion. And they moved on to Ai, and they looked up there and they're like, well, you know, we can send the JV team up there. This is going to be a snap. One afternoon, this will be done. And they got routed. And a handful of men were killed. And then Joshua began to search for the man who had, because God said, somebody did something wrong. And he found Achan, and this is what he said. When I saw among the spoil a beautiful cloak from Shinar and 200 shekels of silver and a bar of gold weighing 50 shekels, I coveted them and took them. I wanted something that wasn't supposed to be mine. Why would he do that? Because he envied the kind of life that those Canaanite people were living. He saw in Jericho this life. Here's a nation of people that's been on foot traveling for 40 plus years. No place to call home. And they come into this country that they're going to take. The spies who have already told them what a lush and wonderful place it is to live. And they see the way these people in Jericho are living. And Achan said, I want to live like that. We covet other things. What did Ananias and Sapphira cover? You know, at the end of Acts chapter 4, Luke records there that at the beginning of the time of the church, in order to support people who were lacking in the basic necessities, Christians were selling off property and giving the money to the apostles and letting them distribute it. And Ananias and Sapphira saw that happening. And in chapter 5, they came to the apostles and said, hey, here's some money. We sold a piece of land. And a very innocent question. Is this all you got for it? Yeah, that's all we got for it. Why would they do that? What is the problem with saying, actually, that's about half of what we got for it? You think Peter would have said, well, where's the rest of it? I think Peter would have said, well, thank you for the contribution. But they lied. Why did they lie? Because this husband and wife envied the glory of those other people giving things and the honor that was being bestowed. And they wanted that. They coveted that. It cost them their lives. Not the man who came to Jesus in Luke 12. Master, tell my brother to give me my inheritance. You know, if Jesus had been a lawyer, he might say, well, you got some legal standing here. Because he's supposed to give you The portion of the inheritance that's yours. Let's find out the fact. You know what Jesus said to him? Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness. Life does not consist of the abundance of one's possessions. The problem that man was that he had was not an inheritance he couldn't get his hands on. It was covetousness in his heart. He envied. He envied his brother. He envied others who might have things that he wanted. It's even possible, gasp, that he'd already spent part of it. We would never do that. He might have had the Visa or MasterCard out running up bills, and now I got to pay them because he wanted to keep up. The problem is we have a desire for things that are not ours, but we need to remember that if we serve God, he has made a promise to us. We will be cared for. Jesus didn't slip in verse 33 of Matthew 6 in the Sermon on the Mount just as an aside. Seek me first and the kingdom of heaven, and all these things will be added to you. You know what kind of promise that is? That's the kind of promise that takes every worry that we have in our lives about sustenance off the table. It is no longer a bargaining chip that Satan can use to tempt us with envy and covetousness. Because we have said to him, none of that matters. God's taking care of that. But we won't do that. Thirdly, envy brings bitterness and anger and complaints. You know, this is the one that bothers me the most for me. It may bother you too. We don't like it when other people are blessed. Brethren, that's not just wrong. That's diabolical. We take pleasure in other people's failures. I'm not saying that we should not desire to see people who are engaged in sin fail. I don't want them to succeed. I don't want them to tempt other people. But we look around us at other people and think, I don't like that guy. I don't like his attitude. I want him to fail. I'll tell you, in a very trivial sense, this hit me the other night as I was sitting here thinking about this lesson and watching the basketball game. This is the one time of year when I actually watch pro basketball, because the rest of the time I really don't care about it. I'm not a big LeBron James fan. Some people are. I got a couple of sons who think he's great. He is a terrific talent. But then it struck me as I'm watching that game that I'm not pulling for the team he's playing against. I'm pulling against him. And I thought, what has he ever done to me? Nothing. Why shouldn't he be allowed to succeed if he's got the ability? And I've heard him say before that he recognizes his ability as God-given. Now, he may not serve the Lord, but he knows where his talent came from. He knows, you know, I didn't work hard to be 6'8". You don't work hard at that. It happens. So why should I care? Should I not take joy when others succeed, when others have success, when others are blessed in some way, even if those people are people I don't know, or people I may not care about their attitude? But we're not like that. We want to see other people fail. And I'll tell you what really bothers me sometimes is we don't want to just see them fail. We want to see them fail spectacularly. We want to see them fail on the biggest stage, in the most humiliating way. That's not right. You shouldn't have that kind of attitude toward anybody. Because if not for the grace of God, we would all fail. We'd have no chance. So we should not wish that on anybody. But envy does that. It started early. Cain was envious of the approval of Abel. Was he not? Isn't that what caused all of his problem? God came to him. Cain was very angry, Genesis 4, and his face fell. The Lord said to him, why are you angry and why is your face fallen? If you do well, and will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desires for you, but you must rule over it. The Bible said that Cain's look gave him away. His face fell. He wasn't sorry that God had rejected his sacrifice. He was enraged that God had accepted Abel's. And so he was going to do something about it. Instead of being angry at himself for not answering God's call properly, he blamed it on Abel and he blamed it on God. He envied his brother's approval. And even God patiently trying to turn him away, he pointed out the folly of this thought process. He pointed out the danger of not repenting. But as Jesus taught in Matthew chapter 5, envy leads to hatred, and hatred leads to murder. And that's just what he did. He thinks he's so righteous. And many times the world looks at Christians. I don't say us. Sometimes we're not in that boat. But looks at Christians. Well, you're just too goody. You just think you never do anything wrong. I don't want to be part of y'all because I'm not good enough. Well, y'all are just perfect. Far from it. Way far from it. And after he slaughtered his brother and God came to him, what did he say? Am I my brother's keeper? God, you're such a hotshot know-it-all. Can't you keep up with your followers? Why you got to come ask me? There's no real surprise at why God would mark a man like that and send him away. Full of envy, full of hatred, full of anger. Israel had that kind of problem. This went on for decades. Every time something bad happened, what did they do? They murmured against God. And this is what envy leads to, the bitterness. It leads to a murmuring. In Numbers 11, one of the many circumstances where the people complained in hearing of the Lord about their misfortunes. And when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some outlying parts of the camp. There are some sins. Every sin threatens to separate us from God. But the scriptures are very clear that there are some sins that really enrage God. And complaining about our lot to God is one of those things. Brethren, we don't have any ant boy. You just look at the cross and ask, what in the world do you have to complain about? There's nothing to complain about. Murmuring was something that the New Testament was very familiar with too. They grumbled against Jesus. Remember when he went to Levi's house in Luke chapter 5? And he's sitting there eating and the publicans or the Pharisees looked at him and said, what? Why do you and your disciples eat with sinners? Well, Jesus could have retorted very smart-alecky and said, there's nobody else to eat with. But he didn't say that. He said, those who are sick need a doctor. Those who are not, don't. But they complained. In John 6, when he said, I'm the bread of life. Who is this guy? Instead of stopping and thinking about, he's the bread of life, what could he mean by that? There's something here. And I need to find... They didn't do that. Let's just dismiss him. He's stealing our thunder. He's undermining our attempts to lead these people. None of us like it when other people engage in this kind of behavior. But brethren, it doesn't look any better on us. It really doesn't. What can we do about envy? There's three things I want to suggest to you. We can love our neighbor, not what our neighbor has. Do you love your neighbor's things more than you love your neighbor? Are you more attracted and friendly toward those people who have more things? What are you concerned about most? The things your neighbor has, or his lost soul? Jesus told that brother who came, take care and be on guard against covetousness. We need to be caring about people's relationship to God. Because really nothing else matters. It's not going to matter. Second, we need to trust God to provide for us. The truth is that we aren't very trusting of God. And mainly that's because we got a different shopping list than God. You thought about that? Here are the things I want. Here's the thing God... Yeah. I don't really want that. I want this. And I pray about that. And what did James say in James chapter 4 about those who were envious? What causes quarrels? What causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? You desire and do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You want all the wrong things. You want all the trappings of this life that you think will make you happy. We'll talk to Jack Whitaker about that. Go ask him about the happiness that possessions buy. Go ask him if he'd trade every penny that he got for his granddaughter's life. In a heartbeat. In half a heartbeat. God's promise to meet our needs. Jesus said, pray, as Jeff was talking about his prayer in Matthew 6 today, give us this day our daily bread. We're not satisfied with that. I want all year. Give me the whole year. That's not what he said. Take care of it one day at a time. That's how our discipleship works. Doesn't mean we don't plan. And Jesus talked about planning. It means when it comes to our behavior before God and our discipleship, Jesus said, sufficient is the trouble for today. Don't worry about tomorrow. Take care of today. Tomorrow will take care of itself with all of its problems and all of its issues. Envy focuses us on earthly provisions. Godliness focuses us on heavenly provisions. Those that don't, if we store those things up, they don't decay, they don't rot, they don't go bad. Finally, we need to be content with our wages. John the Baptist in Luke chapter 3 came into the wilderness teaching this. Got some hesitation, but also got a lot of people who responded. Listen to this from Luke 3, beginning in verse 7. He said to the crowds that came out to be baptized by him, "You brood of vipers! Who warned you to flee from the wrath to come? Bear fruits in keeping with repentance. And do not begin to say to yourselves, 'We have Abraham as our father.' For I tell you, God is able from these stones to raise up children for Abraham. Even now the axe is laid at the root of the trees. Every tree, therefore, that does not bear fruit is cut down, good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire." John taught repentance, a changing of the way you live. Turn around and go another direction. And he got pretty specific if you keep reading in verse 10. The crowds asked him, "What shall we do?" And he answered, "Whoever has two tunics is to share with him who has none. And whoever has food is to do likewise." Tax collectors came to be baptized and said to him, "Teacher, what shall we do?" And he said, "Collect no more than you're authorized to do." Soldiers asked him, "And what shall we do?" And he said, "Do not extort money from anyone by threats or by false accusation, and be content with your wages." A fundamental reassessment of the way you're living. This is what leads to repentance. Is when we sit down and we look at our lives and you say, you know, this right here makes me happy, but it doesn't make God happy. I'm wanting things that from the spiritual perspective will harm me. As I read the story of Jack Whitaker, I began to think of the number of people who claim to be Christians. I don't have enough fingers and toes. Who I have heard make comments like, "Man, if I just had $1 million, all the problems it would solve." Really? How could that guy get... If I won $313 million, I would know how to take care of it. The studies that have been conducted, this is no surprise if you've read anything. Studies conducted of people who've won enormous amounts of money. By and large, the overwhelming majority of them crash and burn. Destroys their lives. Now, there are a few. And the few that are characterized by the fact that their life does not markedly change when they get that money are the ones who survive, and that's the term that's used to describe them. They survive this plague. As I was reading this story, the thing that struck me is that although Whitaker said his life would have been easier if he hadn't had that, he never got rid of all of it. He's still a very wealthy man. About 10 years after he won this prize, he was playing the West Virginia Powerball again. Six numbers. He got five of them right. He almost won again. Why would somebody do that? You would think a person who went through the kind of personal anguish he went through would be beating down the door of the legislature to say, you got to stop this. It's not very many people, but you're ruining their lives. Are we letting envy infiltrate our... It's a sinister thing. It's a subtle thing. We think, well, I'm not coveting what someone else has, and that's good enough. Envy is a jealousness at how others have blessings. And listen, brethren, Jesus said it rains on the just and the unjust. Wicked people... Jeff talked this morning about the unrighteous mammon. There are wicked people in this world who are wise in the ways of this world. They know how to make money, and they make it, and they're wealthy, and they don't care about God, and they don't care about doing what's right. They have the benefit of working and living in a world where God blesses the righteous. We talked about that last week. It's okay. That's not what we're after. And we ought not want all of the trappings, perhaps, but tragedies that come with an envy for those things and the bitterness and the resentment. Jack Whitaker is still alive. He's a very bitter man. Very bitter man. He's lost everything. Now, you think about that. The day that he won that, on Christmas morning 2002, he got up, and the night before, he actually thought he'd gotten five of the six numbers right. But they announced one of the numbers incorrectly. So when he got up the next morning, he realized he'd won. If you had said to him, you know what, that money is going to destroy your life, he'd have fallen out laughing. How could that destroy my life? Think of all the things that I'm going to be able to do with it. He immediately took it and gave 10% of what... When he got that, he took a lump sum check, which is another ridiculous thing. He won $300 million, he got $93 million after taxes. That's what he got. Well, okay, you can live on that. He took that, gave 10% of it, 10% each, to three different preachers that he knew, man in his community. They built church buildings. Took the money and built church buildings. He gave over half of the money away. But that still was a ridiculous amount of money for a man who's already wealthy. And he took it and showered it on an innocent young teenage girl, his granddaughter, thinking this will make her happy. And he'll live with that for the rest of his life. That this is what led to her self-destruction. We think we know, but we don't. We think we can handle it, but we can't. Let's be thankful to God that He's blessed us with what we have, and not an overabundance that would cause us to be envious. And if we do have that kind of thought in our mind and in our heart, let's trust in God. Let's talk to Him, as Jeff talked about this morning. Save us from that. It is, in my opinion, in the culture we live in, the greatest threat to our salvation is the material wealth that we enjoy in this country. And it is very difficult to handle properly. I've gone way over. I apologize. Pick up your songbooks. Let's sing the song that Jeff has selected.